This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Everest, revised and updated edition, Mountain Without Mercy, by Broughton Coburn. This book is read by Mark Peckham. For the Venerable Ungawang Tenzing Zhangpo, the Incarnate Lama of the Tengboche Monastery. In 1996, McGillivray Freeman Films filmed an amazing story that unfolded on the tallest mountain on Earth. In May of that year, Mount Everest claimed the lives of 15 climbers in its deadliest season ever. The resulting IMAX film, Everest, became the highest-grossing documentary film of all time, surpassing $152 million at the box office. In response to the film's overwhelming international success, McGillivray Freeman Films returned to the mountain in 2007 to document the largest-ever study of hypoxia. 40 doctors and 200 patients turned Everest into the highest medical laboratory ever conceived. The upcoming film, based on that challenging and heroic effort, Return to Everest, will be released in 2017. Audiences can still experience Everest in select IMAX theaters, by streaming online or on DVD. In this updated edition of Everest, Mountain Without Mercy, we have kept the core story of the film expedition, the tragedies, and the rescues. We have illustrated it both with photographs, taken during the expedition, signaled by 1996 at the beginning of a caption, and with pictures taken before and since. We have added a feature called Flash Forward, that gives a glimpse of what has happened to many of the main characters in the drama since 1996. We have updated maps and statistics to the best of our ability as of May 2015, when the full impact of the April 2015 earthquake and avalanche was still unknown. Forward. The Changing Face of Everest, by Conrad Anker. What is it that attracts us to Everest? The lack of oxygen and the extreme cold make it inhospitable. The steep, icy slopes give gravity the upper hand. Any mistake is magnified and can result in injury or death. Somehow, in spite of this, there is a draw. Is it as simple as pioneering Everest climber George Mallory's pithy yet rhetorical answer when asked why he climbed? Because it's there. Is it the allure of experiencing nature in its most raw and unbridled form? Or is it the ego, which motivates so many human actions? Perhaps it is a combination of all these things. Standing on the summit confirms a sense of ruggedness, perseverance, and skill, attributes that would make any person proud. Regardless of the motivation, climbing Everest is a quest that many have dreamed of but relatively few have undertaken. Climbing Everest has become symbolic of human achievement ever since the first recorded summit in 1953. As much as that goal stands fixed and permanent in the world's imagination, the forces of plate tectonics means that Everest continues to grow taller regardless of our presence on its slopes. In the 6+ decades since it was first climbed, it is estimated to have risen just over 12 centimeters. Though it's gotten higher since Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay's summit in 1953, in many ways the peak has become easier to climb. On the standard routes both from Nepal and Tibet, ropes guide climbers from the mountain's base to the summit. Affixed to the ropes are ascenders, mechanical clamps that allow secure upward travel. In the 1950s, climbers used rope to stay tethered to each other as they ventured into the unexplored. Today, fixed ropes allow climbers and Sherpa guides to move more freely and provide an escape hatch in case of bad weather or accidents. What was once unexplored is now a sidewalk stamped into condition. Climbers acclimatize in camps built decades before, their platforms carved into the mountainside. Oxygen systems are more efficient today, delivering the element most vital to human survival at half the weight the 1950s teams had to carry. The use of supplemental oxygen has become a choice rather than a necessity. If reaching the summit is the priority, the question has become, how much oxygen can a climber afford? Climbers with means can hire Sherpas to lug expensive bottles of gas up the mountain for them. Life at base camp features heated tents, fresh food, and real-time communications, which all bring the experience much closer to civilization. The Nepali staff make the present-day Everest experience almost comfortable. From the porters to the cooks to the high-altitude guides, modern Everest expeditions rest on the shoulders of the people employed to help climbers realize their dreams. Everest has risen, and our hopes and ambitions have continued to rise along with it. Yet big dreams and small comforts can't stop Everest from being a dangerous place. Tragedy has struck expeditions on Everest for as long as people have been climbing it. In 1922, 7 Sherpas lost their lives in an avalanche. The same dynamic took place 92 years later, on April 18, 2014, when a massive ice avalanche killed 17 Nepali climbers. The Sherpas killed in this accident were all working for visiting climbers, carrying their equipment up through the treacherous Khumbu Icefall. In truth, the risks of climbing Everest haven't gone away. Climbers have increasingly transferred those risks onto the Sherpas instead of themselves. The 2014 tragedy brought the world's attention to the personal and cultural costs associated with high-altitude Himalayan climbing, the same costs that came into sharp relief on May 10th and 11th, 1996. When MacGillivray Freeman Films sent an IMAX film team to Everest in 1996, the mountain was in full swing transition from nation-based expeditions to commercial guiding. Where before teams were fueled by patriotic ambition, now they were motivated by ego, supported by personal, corporate, and philanthropic backing, all wanting to stand on top of the world. Smaller multinational teams, professional, organized, and with extensive Sherpa support, were becoming the norm. The first news of the 1996 Everest tragedies reached me on my morning commute on a rainy spring day in Oakland, California. The state reporter for National Public Radio announced the effects of a sudden storm on the southeast buttress of Everest. In one day, 8 climbers lost their lives. It was the deadliest single day in Everest history. For me, it was a haunting moment. Several of the guides and clients were my friends and peers in the international climbing community. Rob Hall and I guided together in Antarctica. Scott Fisher was a man whom I looked up to. As the day unfolded, I learned more about the storm that had unexpectedly slammed into the Everest Massif. In 1996, weather forecasting was general, and based on the success of the previous season. We have since replaced luck with more refined and accurate forecasts for wind and precipitation, but by all accounts, May 11th was an auspicious day. The attention-grabbing headlines changed the way the public viewed the planet's highest peak. They made it clear that the bar for entry on Everest, one set by climbing experience, was now determined by the depth of one's bank account. This notable season also established the now annual attention that fixes on Everest each May. After 1996, we thought fewer people would want to climb the mountain. Instead of keeping inexperienced climbers at bay, the disaster seemed to draw them toward Everest in ever-growing numbers. The 1996 season prompted heart-wrenching sadness and complex questions about commercialization and crowding on Everest. But did it change the way we climb the mountain, both physically and emotionally? The helicopter-assisted ascent in 2014 is an example of how climbing has changed on Everest. The Nepali climbing community voluntarily ended the season after the April 18th avalanche, but one climber chose to pursue the summit, flying over the ice fall and striking for the summit with a team of top-drawer climbing Sherpas. While an isolated incident, it is a testament to how, for some, the prize, summiting Everest, may now be reached without the journey. This new development forever changes the nature of the game. Everest will continue to be pushed higher into the troposphere, and if history is anything to go on, our interest will follow. Our fascination with the human condition at 29,000 feet is not going to fade away, even in the face of tragedy. We want to understand why humans are driven to endure a degree of suffering and risk that may cost them their lives. Some things have changed on Everest, but the fundamental story remains the same. It has always been about the desire to challenge the unknown. About how facing uncertainty, at minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit without oxygen, standing at the edge of our capability, allows us a glimpse into our own souls. That is why Everest, Mountain Without Mercy, and the award-winning IMAX film that inspired it is as relevant today as it was when it was first published in 1997. As you read through these pages, you might ask yourself, what would it be like to be caught on that mountain? What would I do if I was? Prologue. On the morning of May 10th, the steep knife-edge ridge connecting the south summit of Mount Everest to the Hillary Step was clearly visible from Camp 2, 7,300 vertical feet below. High clouds raced past the summit, and high winds scoured the southeast ridge, emitting a distant, ominous roar. In the early afternoon, David Brashears and Ed Viesters trained their binoculars on the south summit and spotted six or seven climbers traversing the ridge. Directly ahead, several more climbers were waiting at the base of the Hillary Step, an awkward and craggy stretch of 40 vertical feet of rock and snow leading to the summit that can only be managed one climber at a time. David and Ed would later learn that the ropes needed to assist climbers had been fixed on the step later in the morning than guides Rob Hall and Scott Fisher had planned. Even when fixed promptly, a time-consuming bottleneck can occur when too many climbers arrive at the step at the same time. Squinting into a telescope, David and Ed calculated the climbers' rate of ascent and their use of bottled oxygen. Their oxygen might last through the summit attempt, and the weather was fair. Nevertheless, Ed's face worked with concern. It was very late in the day for climbers to be attempting the summit. Because it can take 18 hours to make the round trip from Camp 4 to the top of Everest under the best of conditions, almost all climbers try to summit before midday. The climbers Ed and David observed would almost certainly be descending in the fading light of late afternoon, a potentially dangerous situation. They've already been climbing 14 hours and they still aren't on the summit. Why haven't they turned around? Ed asked David. There was no answer. Ed was glad of one thing, that he wasn't waiting in line with them. Ed and Paula Viesters had been on Everest with New Zealander Rob Hall's group the two previous years, and Paula was chatting with Helen Wilton, Hall's manager at the New Zealand base camp. They were eager to hear news from the summit, and at about 1:25 p.m., whoops and cheers issued from the dining tent of American Scott Fisher's Mountain Madness group. His guides and clients had just radioed from the top. Fisher himself had said he was having a slow day. He had not reached the summit yet, but apparently chose to continue climbing slowly rather than help guide his clients down. They passed him as they descended. Neither Rob Hall nor his clients had made it to the top yet. Around 2:30, Paula and Helen heard Hall's summit radio call. It was windy, he reported. Those on his team who had summited were descending, except for client Doug Hansen. He could see Hansen approaching slowly and had decided to wait for him at the top. Paula was surprised that Rob would summit with a client this late, contrary to his own rule that his team should descend no later than 2 p.m. Paula was tempted to join in the cheering, but thought it premature. She worried about Hansen, and was well aware of how dangerous and treacherous Everest could be. The year before, Chantal Maudoui had been climbing behind Ed Viesters, when she collapsed at the South Summit while attempting to be the first woman to summit without supplemental oxygen. In an extremely difficult rescue, the Sherpas, Ed, Rob Hall, and two other climbers had to drag and lower her down the summit ridge to Camp 4 on the South Col. On that climb, Ed had also encountered Hall's client Doug Hansen staggering below the south summit. Hansen was not clipped into the fixed rope, and Ed shouted at him to stop. Ed gave Hansen his only oxygen bottle, but Hansen was still having trouble descending, even as Guy Cotter, Hansen's guide, assisted him back to the south col. "Keep me informed," Paula told Helen, as she returned to her base camp kitchen tent to make dinner. Chapter 1 A Mountain of a Dream. Several seasons of good weather have led people to think of Everest as benevolent, Everest film expedition leader David Brashears observed. But in the mid-80s, before many of the guides had been on Everest, there were three consecutive seasons when no one climbed the mountain because of the ferocious wind. Everest can be a place where people can't see or move, where tents are ripped apart, where all the high-tech gear in the world can't save you. Yet Everest casts a spell, and many remain undeterred. Between 1921 and 1996, more than 169 people died on the mountain, one for every five who reached the summit. Since then, a swell in the number of guided treks up Everest has seen that ratio come closer to one death for every 55 ascents. But nothing assures safety on the world's highest mountain. In the 19 years since 1996, 112 people have died on the mountain. Most of the dead are still there. Mount Everest hasn't always attracted such misfortune. As far as is known, no one considered climbing Everest until long after the British commissioned the Great Trigonometrical Survey, a monumental effort to survey and measure all of India and the Himalaya. Undertaken in the mid-19th century, the survey identified the world's tallest mountain, assigned it a provisional height, and gave it a name, Mount Everest, in honor of India's previous surveyor general, George Everest. An unusual concept. Filmmaker Greg McGillivray, a pioneer of large format cinematography, had long been fascinated by Everest exploration and mountaineering, the dramatic story of human achievement and heroism set against almost insurmountable odds. He carefully studied climbing films, which he felt were limited in their ability to capture the splendor of the mountains and the spectacle of climbing them. Someone had to be able to do it better, and IMAX was the medium to match the Himalaya. In IMAX theaters, audiences are surrounded by six channels of synchronized digital sound, and scenes are projected at 10 times the resolution of a 35mm feature film on screens that are up to 8 stories tall and 100 feet wide. Just as the wide screen of CinemaScope was perfect for the landscapes of John Ford's westerns of the 1950s, McGillivray said, the more vertical ratio aspect of IMAX is perfect for Everest. In June of 1994, McGillivray contacted David Brashears to ask if he might like to shoot and direct the on-mountain visuals for a film on Everest and help organize the expedition to the mountain. Brashears was the obvious choice. A veteran of 18 Himalayan expeditions, he was the first American to summit Everest twice and had already made many films on and around the mountain. He was intrigued by McGillivray's proposal, but concluded that hauling a full-size IMAX camera to the summit would be impossible. Always game for a challenge, within the realm of safety, however, Brashears figured he'd try to convince McGillivray to shoot the high mountain footage in a more manageable format, such as 35mm. "I'm interested," he responded confidently. Brashears had transmitted the first live television images from Everest Summit 11 years earlier and knew that a feature movie camera would be only slightly larger than a video camera. But McGillivray was firm. The images would have to be shot in IMAX. Smaller formats, he argued, wouldn't work on the big screens of the museum theaters that typically show these large format films. He could see the logistical problems that transporting the camera posed, but wouldn't lower his expectations. His production company would simply have to build a smaller camera and then provide the resources and support for an expedition that could make it happen. Brashears accepted, and he began by providing specifications for a modified IMAX camera. He soon found out what many had learned the hard way. In IMAX, nothing is easy. Weight will be one challenge, Brashears said with visible concern. The risks of climbing above 26,000 feet were well documented and frightening, as he knew from earlier expeditions. He had escorted one blind and exhausted climber down the southeast ridge and had recovered bodies from all over the mountain. Most of these climbers were victims, at least indirectly, of the effects of altitude. On Everest, the margin of safety is extremely small. Greg McGillivray wanted to produce a film that would educate as it entertained. To identify and explore the unique issues that relate to Mount Everest, he and Brashears carefully assembled a team of 10 academic advisors. These advisors, all longtime observers of the Himalaya, portrayed an unusual and dynamic mountain. Geologists described Everest not as a static geological monument, but as a mountain in motion. Meteorologists explained that the Himalaya and its associated plateau are thought to influence much of the world's weather patterns. Physiologists observed that Everest's summit is at the very limit of man's ability to survive. And anthropologists portrayed the rich culture of the Sherpa, a resourceful people who have thrived in the shadow of these mountains for more than four centuries. Over a period of a year, an experienced team was assembled, consisting of four climbers, four filmmakers, two base camp support staff, 24 Sherpas, and three on-site advisors and journalists. A total of 37 people on the mountain. To Kathmandu. Before 1950, Everest expeditions approached the mountain through Tibet. Nepal's complementary barriers of topography and isolationist policy had effectively insulated it from the rest of the world. But in that year, Nepal began to open its borders to the outside world. For climbers, the gates to a tantalizing, magical, and daunting kingdom had been unlocked. 8 of the world's 10 highest mountains are located within Nepal, or on the border with Tibet or Sikkim, and until the 1950s, none of them had been climbed. In early March 1996, the Everest Film Expedition members departed their countries for Kathmandu, Nepal's capital, a scenic destination from any approach. As a plane begins its descent into the city, half the Nepali Himalaya are visible. From Dalagiri to Everest, the world's most imposing peaks rise like an apparition. Mountain slopes graced with snow and forested high valleys beckon seductively. The plane crosses a pass and the city appears, surrounded by corn and rice terraces that are sculpted on the rim of the Kathmandu Valley like topographic map contours. From the taxi window, it is clear that this ancient city is embracing the transition from the 12th century to the 21st. But the pavement and neon seem a temporary and superficial dressing, as if the city's urban cows, wandering sadhus, centuries-old temples, and stone deities will momentarily rise up and sweep aside the trappings of the modern age. The team members converged on the Yak and Yeti Hotel. "What country is your expedition from?" one hotel guest asked. "Spain, Japan, Austria, the UK, India, Nepal, and the U.S., to start with." Stacked on the reception desk was a colorful pile of dog-eared passports. Climbers, filmmakers, and advisors. David Brashears knew that in selecting climbers, experience and compatibility would be critical. The team would be spending at least 2.5 months together. He and Greg McGillivray wanted an international team as well, and to offer a shot at Everest for expert climbers who might not otherwise have the opportunity. For deputy leader McGillivray and Brashears chose American mountaineer Ed Viesters, a 3-time Everest summiter who was keen to climb it again, his 3rd time without supplemental oxygen. After graduating from the University of Washington in 1981, Ed attended Washington State University's Veterinary School and guided for RMI, a guide service on Mount Rainier. In 12 years, he summited Rainier 187 times. He also climbed Denali and Aconcagua before being invited to Everest in 1987. By 1996, he had embarked on a quest he called Endeavor 8000 to summit the world's 14 highest peaks, those over 8,000 meters, 26,250 feet, without supplemental oxygen. He completed that quest in 2005, making him one of only six people to have climbed all of the world's highest peaks without bottled oxygen, and the only American. "This is a personal goal for me," Ed explained. "It's not for fame." Friends have nicknamed him Steady Ed for his consistency and professionalism. "One of the joys of being with Ed is knowing you are in the presence of a superior being," Brashear has summarized. "His stamina and reliability are phenomenal." Ed's wife, Paula Viesters, had worked in base camp on a previous expedition, and the filmmakers chose her to be base camp manager. A hiker and beginning climber, she would provide logistical support while the climbers were on the mountain. McGillivray and Brashears next chose Araceli Segarra of Lleida, Catalonia, whom Brashears had met a year earlier on the north side of Everest. A professional physiotherapist, Araceli is a versatile ice, rock, and alpine climber. She climbed the south face of Shisha Pungma, 26,291 feet, alpine style, in 1992, and in 1995 she attempted the north face of Everest, reaching 25,591 feet. If successful, she would be the first Catalan and Spanish woman to climb Mount Everest. Araceli came to climbing through spelunking. Having trained for years in Spain's vast limestone cave systems, she brought an abundance of enthusiasm and optimism to the team. "Mainly, I like to climb with friends and to enjoy, especially when there's a nice route. When I climb a rock wall, I dance and connect movements without thinking or breathing the words, 'I'm falling, I'm falling.' And with friends, there is nothing better." Climbing leader Jomling Tenzing Norgay of Darjeeling, West Bengal, India, is an experienced mountaineer and expedition organizer. This would be his first Everest attempt. His father, Tenzing Norgay, reached the summit of Mount Everest with Sir Edmund Hillary on the historic first ascent in 1953. A devout Buddhist like his father, Jomling deeply respects the deities that reside on and around Everest. "Each year on the anniversary of my father's climb, the 29th of May, at least one member of my family places a silk kata blessing scarf on the scroll painting of Myo Lang Sangma, the goddess of Everest, that we keep on our altar. It was to her that my father expressed gratitude when he reached the summit. I'm hoping that the culture of the Sherpas will be viewed more widely as a result of the film of this expedition," he added. In 1975, Junko Tabe was the first woman to summit Everest. By 1996, no other Japanese woman had yet climbed it. Brashears met Sumio Tsuzuki in 1990 on the north side of Everest. She had been on Everest twice before and had climbed to 23,000 feet on Everest's North Col in 1995. Sumio would be documenting the expedition on video. "To go on an expedition and climb, you need high concentration, which we do not have in city life," Sumio said. "That I enjoy." To help muscle around the streamlined IMAX camera and for an extra head to think in conditions of oxygen starvation, David would need to work with another accomplished climbing cinematographer. Robert Schauer of Graz, Austria, assistant cameraman for the film team, is David's European mirror image. "I had read about Robert when I was younger," Brashears said, "and it's an honor for me to climb and to film with him." Schauer had produced or co-produced 12 mountain and adventure films and documentaries, and had climbed five of the world's 14 8,000-meter peaks. He was the first Austrian to reach Everest's summit, 18 years earlier. "Pleased with the chosen team," Robert noted. "We are already working together well, and our humor and spirit are flowing." A few days after the climbing and film teams arrived, A seasoned Nepal hand dragged several battered bags into the Yak and Yeti. They belonged to Roger Billum, a professor of geology at the University of Colorado in Boulder and advisor to the film. Two of the suitcases were filled with tools, transistors, superglue, batteries, a laptop computer, and some heavy wire that looked suspiciously like bent coat hangers. "Roger knows a great deal about everything," David said proudly. Ed referred to the transplanted British national as "our team geophysicist." Roger had already been working with the government of Nepal on establishing a network of global positioning system, GPS satellite receivers, to measure movements of the tectonic plates beneath the Himalaya. He would be taking GPS readings along the approach route, which partly follows the dynamic junction of the Eurasian and Indian landmasses. He would also oversee the placement of the world's highest weather station at 26,800 feet on Everest, and take a GPS reading there as well. Another British national joining the team as correspondent was historian Audrey Salkeld. She had written a book about George Mallory and Sandy Irvine, the Everest explorers who had disappeared in 1924, either en route to the summit or while descending. Though not a climber herself, Audrey had been to the north side of Everest with David Brashears in 1986. Steve Judson, one of the more experienced writers and directors of large-format IMAX films, had been on numerous shoots, but none quite as remote or logistically difficult as Everest. As co-writer with Tim Cahill and editor of the film, Steve would be working with photographic and technical consultant Brad Oland, who had 20 years of experience as a second-unit director of photography with McGillivray Freeman Films. Steve and Brad would travel to base camp. En route, they would help David and Robert develop their large-format cinematography skills. Once the camera went above base camp, David and Robert would be on their own. The team knew that virtually no ascent of Everest had begun without the indigenous people of the Everest region, the Sherpas. Most of the 20 Sherpas hired for the film expedition had flown or hiked to Kathmandu from Khumbu, the valleys that enclose the approach route to base camp. They brought with them, as always, their customary good cheer and playful humor. Wangchu Sherpa, the Sardar, headman, in charge of the Sherpas and Nepal logistics, was among the most entertaining members of the team. He seemed to revel in the constant battle with bureaucrats over the frustrating permit process, and over which his joking banter and quick-wittedness usually prevailed. David and Wangchu were on Everest together in 1986. Wangchu himself had climbed Everest from the north in 1995 and had acted as Sardar for several expeditions. "I now hire the climbing Sherpas who hired me. We joke about this," Wangchu said. Why climb? For climbing Sherpas, climbing is a job, not something they would undertake for sport. Climbing Sherpas can make $1,200 to $5,000 a season in a country with a per capita income of around $700 a year. But only the top Sardars and those with access to investment money own houses and businesses in the capital, where land prices exceed those of many wealthy American residential communities. So what motivates the others who come to Everest? "Maybe they have lots of time and money and don't know what to do with it," one Sherpa offered. Paradoxically, though religion forms the fabric of the Sherpas' lives, it may be the foreigners who bring a more introspective, philosophical approach to the mountain. Willie Unsald, my articulate climbing companion in the West Ridge in 1963, saw in Everest the values of dreaming, striving, risk, going beyond oneself, and caring for our earth and our relationship to it, wrote Tom Hornbein. Brashears agrees. Climbing Everest is about the deprivations, the challenge, the sheer physical beauty, the movement and rhythm. And it's partly about risk. You learn about yourself, about what happens when you abandon comfort and warmth and a daily routine. The tyranny of the urgent. You learn how you perform and how you handle a situation that may be life-threatening. There's a reward for your efforts, and a lot of fatigue, too. but I even like the fatigue. I like to wake up in the morning feeling stronger than I was the day before. Clearly, some climbers are on a quest and set out not so much to conquer a physical obstacle as to attain a new level of understanding of themselves. Climbing a high mountain may be modern man's outlet for the classic hero's struggle codified by Joseph Campbell. Approaching, confronting, and then overcoming the weaknesses and demons that haunt us and obstruct us. For this quest, Everest offers the ideal tableau. The Sherpas and other Himalayan Buddhists express this struggle in the form of pilgrimage and in daily rituals. They seek spiritual liberation, but they will settle for gaining merit. The Sherpa people understand what the foreign climbers are seeking. They're just not sure that climbing mountains is the best way to find it. Some climbers who attempt Everest appear to be searching for a sense of power and achievement, for fame and attention. The Sherpas question whether these are proper motivations for being on the mountain. Luck, skill, desire, and money are not sufficient to get one to the top. In order to succeed consistently, the Sherpas say, one's motivation must be pure. They believe Everest and Khumbu's mountains are the domains of gods and goddesses. The mountains exist as much in the realm of the spiritual as they do the physical. Both groups, Sherpas and foreign climbers, share the recognition that humans did not create the Himalaya and that they are beyond man's control. A crowd gathers. In the Kathmandu market, the team ran across New Zealand guide Rob Hall, who claimed to have escorted 39 climbers to the summit of Everest, more than the total number of people that summited during the 20-year period following the first climb in 1953. This year, he brought 8 clients, 2 more than he had ever brought to the mountain. One of them was John Krakauer, sent there to write about the experience and the world of guided climbing for Outside Magazine. American guide Scott Fisher also arrived with a team of guides and clients. Fisher had been on Everest once before, in 1994, when he summited without oxygen. This year, his Seattle-based company, Mountain Madness, had taken on several clients, among them New York adventurer and NBC correspondent Sandy Hill Pittman, who, if she summited Everest, would have successfully climbed all 7 summits, the highest mountain on each continent. Another client was climbing legend Pete Shaning, widely known as a hero for having saved the lives of 6 team members high on K2 in 1953. If Shaning were to reach the summit, he would be the oldest person to climb Everest at 68. At the expedition staging area in the crowded center of Kathmandu, the climbers and Sherpas moved bundles of equipment, gas cylinders, duffels, and boxes of food, while Ed and Paula logged each item. Shooing away curious jungle crows that squawked and hopped about, they stood back and scrutinized the gear and the confusion. "We organized our wedding at the same time we prepared for the expedition," Paula said. "It was hectic. Calculating quantities, locating supplies, and buying and packing the food and equipment became a full-time job for 3 months. 3 tons of gear were shipped from Seattle, 57 food boxes, 30 climbing hardware, and tent loads, including over 40 tents and 50 sleeping pads, 5 science cases, 3,000 feet of rope, 75 bottles of oxygen, hundreds of rolls of toilet paper, and 47 tins of Spam. The film gear was shipped separately. Propane, kerosene, gasoline, and additional food and supplies would be purchased in Kathmandu. Eventually, 250 loads would have to be transported to base camp by helicopter, yak, and porter. McGillivray Freeman's Everest film expedition, not including the science and film components, would cost nearly $750,000, a significant location expense. David Brashears was determined to make the summit, but early on, both he and Greg McGillivray resolved that he wouldn't allow the high stakes of the expedition to compromise their commitment to safety and caution. A popular peak. The team was fortunate to have picked a year when permits to climb Everest from the Nepal side were available on relatively short notice. Prior to 1978, only one expedition per route was allowed each season, and the waiting list for the South Col route, considered to be the easiest, was more than 5 years long. But in that year, the mountaineering section of Nepal's Ministry of Tourism opened up south side routes to more than one climbing team, possibly after they observed that multiple teams were climbing from the north side of the mountain, in Tibet. With only a nominal fee per expedition and few limitations, the number of groups and climbers increased through the 1980s, until the spring season of 1993, when 15 teams, comprising nearly 300 climbers, attempted Everest from the south. The following season, the Ministry of Tourism limited the number of teams to 4, while increasing the royalty to $50,000 per expedition of up to 5 members, plus $10,000 for each additional member to a maximum of 7. In the spring of 1996, rather than impose a ceiling on the number of teams, the government increased the fee to $70,000 per 7-member expedition, plus $10,000 for each additional member, to a maximum of 12. As anticipated, the new policy boosted mountaineering revenues. During the spring of 1996, Everest climbing royalties generated more than $800,000, a large sum for a developing country. Many have complained that only a fraction of this amount has been allocated to environmental conservation or mountain safety, and little has trickled down to the local people. For a client, the average going rate now ranges from $30,000 to $70,000, and organizing a large expedition can cost over $500,000. When Charles Houston, physiology advisor to the film, climbed K2 in 1938, the round-trip cost for the entire expedition was $9,500. The second attempt he led in 1953 cost $35,000. Attracted by the film's potential to promote tourism, the government of Nepal issued the IMAX Everest team a permit in the early spring of 1996. At the time, Bashirs had no idea that his group would be joined on the mountain by 13 other teams, all climbing on the same route and during the same narrow window in May when good weather was expected. The two largest groups alone, those led by Scott Fisher and Rob Hall, would be placing 22 guides and clients and nearly as many Sherpas on a single route up the mountain. Asantol and the city. The team slalomed their way through a maze of people to the very heart of Kathmandu, the busy market area of Asantol. Regardless of their destination in the city, everyone intersects at this six-way hub of narrow alleyways, a crossroad of culture and color. Asantol's Annapurna, goddess of abundance of grain, temple, is appropriately surrounded by burlap sacks of grain, the tops neatly rolled back by merchants for buyers to inspect. Ministers, mendicants, visiting hill people, and pilgrims ring the temple's bells and make offerings to the Hindu and Buddhist deities, then jostle their way through rickshaws, overloaded pushcarts, and breeding bulls that range freely, grazing on vegetable scraps and cardboard. The smells of incense and rotting vegetables meld in a thick, organic vapor. The self-proclaimed global emperor, a Kathmandu temple pundit and eccentric, greeted David Bashirs in an alley near the temple and handed him playing card-sized pictures of deities of the Hindu pantheon with his global messages inscribed on the back. David listened carefully as he imparted advice that contained, without irony, the two most repeated axioms of life in Nepal. "Oh, no, sir, you can't do that here," and "Here, my good man, anything is possible." Filming in Kathmandu proved both axioms. Steve Judson rapidly adjusted to the chaotic medieval location with a sense of humor intact. "The first few times I called for action, everybody stopped and looked at me. Finally, someone informed me that the Nepal term, Ek Chin, means, wait a minute." The teetering, overbuilt character of the old section of Kathmandu lent a mild foreboding to the proceedings. The valley is situated above a huge earthquake fault that underlies most of the Himalaya. And some of the valley's residents are old enough to remember when the city was devastated by the Great Bihar Earthquake of 1934, a year they still count time from. In 1996, some seismologists believed that the next great earthquake would devastate the crowded city. In 2015, an M7.9 earthquake did just that. One concerned citizen is Kathmandu building engineer Hemant Aryal. He recognizes the cantilever design of many buildings and has created welcome space in the city's cramped core. But because the overhangs of the cantilevers can be no wider than 3 feet, the owners tend to construct the walls with bricks stacked on their sides. In addition, the quality of cement mortar is variable. The bricks can be easily dislodged by even the smallest horizontal thrust, Mr. Aryal writes. In a quake, as people run out of their houses to escape, they'll be greeted by a rain of bricks. Additionally, Kathmandu's narrow streets are festooned with a labyrinth of frayed electrical wires that will increase the existing fire hazard from cooking fires. And after a quake, fire trucks won't be able to negotiate the narrow, brick-clogged streets. Perhaps prayer will help. Though Kathmandu is virtually choked with motor vehicles and factories, the valley is still dotted with ancient power spots, geomantic focal points of spiritual energy that valley residents believe confer blessings on those who frequent them. The team members took a break from their stockpiling of supplies to visit Swayambhunath, the monkey temple. For Jamling, Sumio, and the Sherpas, all Buddhists, this was a chance to prepare in another way, by making offerings to the deities of this holy site. The Stupa of Swayambhunath, an ancient hilltop shrine, is sacred to both the Hindus, who entered Nepal from the south centuries ago, and the Buddhists, who came from the north. Swayambhunath means self-arisen, and legend says that the hill on which the stupa is located spontaneously emerged from the lake bed that is now the Kathmandu Valley. Joining the daily stream of supplicants, Jamling and Sumio ascend the 365 stairs to the stupa. They prayed and threw grain from bamboo trays to the hundreds of pigeons and rhesus monkeys that long ago claimed Swayambhunath as their home. These offerings of life bring sonam, or spiritual merit, which contributes to a more favorable rebirth. As they circumambulated the stupa dome, they spun prayer wheels for blessings and good fortune. It is said that the copper repoussé wheels, packed with prayers and mantras block printed on hundreds of scrolled rice paper folios, release the written invocations heavenward with each revolution. A handful of foreign Buddhists, mixing easily with the locals, also chanted and spun. The team frantically tried to fit all the color and action into the widest angle lens while monkeys eyed the film gear. David reminded Brad Oland and Robert Schauer not to leave lenses or equipment unattended, lest they be lifted by these acquisitive rogues. Jamling paused to purchase a long roll of colorful prayer flags that he planned to unfurl on the summit after having them blessed by a High Lama. 25,000 butter lamps. Jamling was saving some of his offerings for the Stupa of Bodhnath, the nerve center and soul of a mostly Tibetan community on the east side of Kathmandu. The stupa's stone skirt had been worn by countless circuits of murmuring faithful Buddhists, the soles of their buffalo hide boots scuffing through a thin layer of dust. Motorized traffic now blocked from entry, growls and shrieks impatiently outside the gates. For the success of the expedition, but mainly for its protection and safety, Jamling sponsored the lighting of 25,000 butter lamps at the stupa. For most of the day on March 17th, Audrey Salkeld and Paula Viesters worked with 30 of the team Sherpas, twisting cotton wicks and rustling up shallow pottery cups that would function as lamps. By late afternoon, they had arranged them along the outline of the three main tiers of the mandala-shaped stupa. The Sherpas and hundreds of devout bystanders, mostly Tibetan, gathered to light the rows of golden lamps. They filled the clay receptacles with their own melted butter, poured from Chinese vacuum flasks. To forfeit consumption of a valuable commodity such as butter, Jamling noted, demonstrates that one is willing to nourish the gods before oneself. The angled surface of the terraces became slick with spilled butter, and the lamps ignited with difficulty. When the last one was lit, the climbers, filmmakers, Sherpas, and support staff climbed a narrow stairway to the roof of an adjacent building. Finally, the entire team had come together in one place. They hugged and filmed as the golden light infused in them a sense of calm, good fortune, warmth, and equanimity, if not a feeling of proximity to the gods. Beyond the stupa, the lights of landing airplanes winked at Venus, which sat placidly above the sunset. Even a small breeze can make it impossible to light the lamps or keep them lit. For 2 nights before the ceremony, Steve and David had scouted the stupa and were twice reminded by the caretakers that it was too windy to consider a butter lamp ceremony. Before the team gathered on the rooftop, a Buddhist nun had approached John Ling with a broad smile and bowed her head slightly in gratitude. She said that although the afternoon had been quite windy, it was propitious that the wind stopped. The gods were looking favorably on John Ling's and the expedition's offering. For John Ling, the nun's words were comforting. His wife, So-young, was not entirely pleased with his Everest plans, and she remained quietly worried. "I asked So-young to give me one chance to climb it so that we wouldn't have regrets later," he said. She agreed, but on one condition, that I consult her family's guru, a Tibetan Lama, and request a mo, a divination. Geshe Rinpoche is an incarnate Lama and is known for his accurate mos. Even the staff of embassies in Kathmandu go to him for advice. Jomling paused. I was afraid he'd tell me not to go. At Geshe Rinpoche's monastery, Jomling climbed several flights of creaking wooden stairs and entered a humble room, barely large enough to hold a table, bed, and 2 or 3 visitors. Rinpoche, swathed in maroon and brocade robes, was sitting cross-legged on the bed. He motioned Jomling to sit and called his assistant to bring tea. He then consulted his rosary. When he looked up from the string of 108 beads, he said, "Go ahead. You'll be successful. It looks favorable." He smiled, aware of Jomling's strong desire to climb the mountain. Jomling asked Rinpoche for a puja, a propitiatory ritual as well. At So-young's family house in Kathmandu, Rinpoche performed a long life ceremony and studied the Tibetan almanac to prescribe the most opportune day for him to depart the house. Jomling followed his words precisely, unwilling to chance anything. The morning of the team's departure, Geshe Rinpoche gave Jomling some powder and blessed grains of sand to sprinkle in dangerous places wherever he might feel afraid, such as avalanche-prone areas and the Khumbu icefall. He also gave Jomling a tiny cloth bag containing hair and other relics of high lamas to place on the summit. Most importantly, Rinpoche presented him with a protective Sunghwa amulet, a piece of handmade paper inscribed with astrological designs and religious symbols, then folded precisely and bound by a crosshatch of colored threads. Jomling wrapped the amulet in plastic to protect it from sweat and dirt, and had it sewn into a yellow brocade bag along with some long life pills. Jomling was greatly relieved. Before leaving Darjeeling, he had consulted Shatrul Rinpoche, his own family's guru, who had also done a mo. Jomling hadn't mentioned that mo's disconcerting results to So-young. Shatrul Rinpoche didn't tell me not to go, but he said Everest looked a little uncertain this year. I could tell that he saw something difficult in the prayer beads. Danger, it seemed. He said nothing more, other than to be careful and that he'd pray for us. Even Jomling was aware that divinations, though often accurate, could be interpreted in several ways. Most important, he must maintain pure intentions on the mountain, the clarity of purpose and dedication that Buddhists refer to as right motivation. Tukumbu. The team was prepared, officially, logistically, physically, and spiritually. Only last-minute details remained, constructing a frame for Roger's solar panels, signing postcards, and changing dollars into bags of rupees for paying porters and yak drivers. At least they wouldn't have to carry baskets of heavy coins, as Charles Houston did with the first party of foreigners to enter Khumbu in 1950. The Sherpas had by then overcome their distrust of paper money and will now even accept travelers' checks. On March 20th, the team assembled at the Kathmandu airport and climbed into a hulking Russian Mi-17 helicopter, a relic from the Afghan War, and squeezed onto fold-down benches along the windows. As the Mi-17 noisily lifted off, the team's whoops and chants nearly drowned out the rotor blades. Jiang Bu, a climbing Sherpa and Wang Chu's right-hand man, shook his head skeptically. "Too much vibration." The team was informed that the helicopters had been used as air taxis for years in the former Soviet Union. As the whirling blades strobed the faces of the group, Araceli looked around nervously. "For how many years?" her worried face seemed to ask. She noticed the paratrooper's clip line leading to the door. The panel behind it was worn shiny from apparent decades of use. The chopper crossed the end of the runway and its shadow leaped out over the rice paddies. It rolled left, to the east, headed for the airstrip of Lukla in the region of Solukhumbu, the northern part of which is termed Khumbu. As the helicopter rose above the diffuse fog blanketing the valley, the Himalaya Mountains emerged, their crystalline forms pushed against a navy blue sky as if visibly being thrust upward by the colliding land masses of India and Eurasia. Like the Himalayan balance of orogeny and erosion, the helicopter's powerful lifting forces were just barely overcoming the relentless pull of gravity. Because the cabin was unpressurized, the pilots wouldn't fly high enough to avoid the chaotic winds that are channeled skyward by the rumpled foothills. The helicopter leveled out at 11,000 feet, barely higher than its destination, and passed Gowri Sunkar. Though this 23,442-foot sacred mountain has been climbed, the Hindus say that Shiva, the god of destruction, occupies the top of its craggy throne. His consort, Gowri, sits on the nearby south summit. Everest is one of the mountains most revered by Sherpa Buddhists. They call it Chomolungma, commonly translated as Mother Goddess of the World or Maiden of the Wind, and known to the Nepalese as Sagarmatha. From the team's distance, the mountain looked miniature as it emerged on the northeast horizon, but a distinctive white plume blew from the summit like a Kata blessing scarf. Jiang Bu said he wondered why anyone would want to rename a mountain as sacred and majestic as Chomolungma after a human. In the valley of the Dudkozi, Milk River, named for its glacial silt, the chopper turned north and followed the Everest trek route to Lukla. From above, the airstrip looked much steeper than the 8 degrees of pitch that has intimidated many pilots, and it dead ends in a sheer wall of rock. If fixed-wing pilots overshoot it, they'll have a first-hand encounter with the Himalaya itself. The first airplane landing at Lukla was made by Emil Wick in 1964. David and other veteran climbers still tell stories of this legendary Swiss pilot, who was stationed in Nepal by the Pilatus Porter factory to fly and maintain its high-performance plane. Wick once flew to 32,000 feet directly over Everest and far above the plane's rated ceiling, while one passenger opened the door for filming. "That height could be reached," Wick said, "only by seeking out and catching the updrafts that funnel up Everest's western coombe to the South Col." After dropping 20,000 feet in a near free fall, Wick sneaked up on the Temboche Monastery, lower than the level of the cupola, and turned to tell his partly thrilled, partly horrified riders, "I want to see if I can spin a few prayer wheels this time." He then jerked the wings to a vertical angle to avoid clipping the tops of two tall prayer flag poles while people on the ground ran for cover. By 1996, the plane's engine had been converted from piston to turbine, a mixed blessing, Emil said, because turbine-powered planes shouldn't be flown upside down. The team climbed out of the monstrous Russian chopper on unsteady legs. At 9,000 feet, the Lukla air was cool and decidedly thinner. Aromas of juniper fires, yak dung, and turboprop exhaust washed over them, displaced briefly by a light breeze of nostril-tingling glacial air flowing down from Khumbu in Tibet. The smell of Everest. Moments later, a siren alerted the gawkers and livestock on the runway, and the Mi-17 lifted off in a glorious cloud of dust to the Sherpas, a wonderful sign of progress. In the fall of 1964, anthropologist Jim Fisher and an associate Completed survey work and land negotiations before grading a sloping meadow to create the Lukla airstrip. It was intended as an access point for building materials and medical supplies for the hospital in Kunda. Built in 1966 by Sir Edmund Hillary's Himalayan Trust. A two-week walk had suddenly been reduced to a 40-minute flight. Now, half a kilometer of lodges and shops line the main route that leads out of town. Understandably, the Lukla people are rallying to halt the growing Russian helicopter traffic to the Siangbocha airstrip to the north. Because Siangbocha is located closer to Everest, trekkers can now bypass Lukla altogether. On the Trail. Ed, Jomling, and Jongbu oversaw the loading of zopkils, male yak-cow crossbreeds that are better adapted than yaks to carrying loads at elevations below 12,000 feet. Slowly, the team moved out of town and headed up the Dudkosi Valley.